seen the sky so blue. The birds are singing, I got nothing to do. Hey, hey,
hey, hey.
It's a sunny day.
Sunny day now.
My pocket's empty, my cupboard's bare. But call me illogical, I just don't care. Hey, hey,
hey, hey.
It's just a sunny day.
Hey, 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 it's a sunny day.
It's just
day.
A sunny day.
It's the KSL Greenhouse. Expert tips for flowers, trees, gardens, and soil. Our hosts are Maria Chaleos and Ton Bettis on KSL News Radio.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Phone lines are open at 801-575-8255. You can text us at 57500. Just a beautiful day. Makes me want to get outside until I go outside, Ton. Boy, it is mighty nippy out there this morning.
It is. I left my house, and it was 27, which doesn't sound too bad, but when you get the humidity from the rain, it will cut right through you at 27 degrees. And
yeah.
Well, I was scraping my truck off this morning. The rain had frozen to the windshield, and that's always interesting too, but it was cold.
Well, good news is for those fair weather lovers like me, is the temperature is climbing up to like 50 degrees, 54 degrees on Monday. So, and today's not too bad, up to 47. So,
this beautiful weather for pruning and getting started in the yard, you know, if there's any leaves that fell over the winter, there's plenty that can be done outside.
Well, I still have perennials that I didn't cut back from fall, but it left some really dead leaves.
Yeah. Wednesday morning, I went outside and noticed that, I don't know how it happened, but there's weeds everywhere in my flower bed.
Yeah, how is that?
So I was weeding out there for like a half hour.
I know.
In the middle of February.
Like, I have this little spot by the driveway, and I'm like, where did these weeds come from? How is this even possible in freezing temperatures? Apparently, they find a way. Plant of the week is the viburnum. We wanted to talk about that this morning.
Viburnums are...
So at first you wanted to talk about one particular viburnum, and then you decided, hey, we should talk about...
We should.
Variety.
I took some time this morning when I came in and looked at several websites about viburnums to just do a quick checklist of how many can be purchased here locally. And I found 13 that you can find locally that are fairly common. And the reason the viburnums are usually grown is that they have pretty spring flowers. And the most common viburnum we grow is the snowball bush. And another name for it is European cranberry bush viburnum or European snowball bush. And that, you know, 8 out of 10 that are sold are going to be a snowball bush. But then you have a whole host of others that are very useful, that oftentimes have very beautiful spring flowers, but they also make great foliage plants. Many of them have really good fall color.
Okay, so other than the snowball bush, what kind of flowers do the others have?
They're usually white flowers. Some of them will have
a tinge
of pink to them. Mm-hmm. But there's several of them. There's one called Cayuga, Fragrant Viburnum, and then Pink Dawn and Birkwood that have very fragrant, and it's a good fragrance, flowers in the spring. And so you can plant them near a door or on a porch, you know, or a patio. And when you're outside, you know, those first days in the 70s that you can enjoy, these Birkwood viburnums or the Pink Dawns will be blooming. And there's just this wonderful fragrance that comes off of them.
And is that with all of the viburnums?
No, a lot of them are not fragrant, but a few are. Others...
I'm trying to remember, does my snowball bush smell like it?
No, it won't.
I didn't think so.
But there's some that are, and then there's others that are evergreen. So, and they need to be protected. There's one called David Viburnum that's an evergreen shrub. And, you know, you go through this list, and another called Marie's Double File has very beautiful flowers. They look like hydrangea, a flat lace cap hydrangea. There's in this Double File, there's other varieties, one called Watanabe that only gets 5 feet tall, that blooms heavily in the spring, but then sporadically through the summer. So the viburnums are underused because most of them will tolerate alkaline soil here really quite well.
Mm-hmm.
And they're, a lot of them, the flowers are pretty. And are they going to be as pretty as Snowball? They won't. But there's other benefits, such as the fall foliage, or if they get some berries, the berries do stick to the bush. They'll offer blue or dark red berries that are then eaten by birds and wildlife in the winter. So they're a group of shrubs that, beyond Snowball bush, are just really not used as much as they could be in Utah.
Do they all get as big as a Snowball bush?
No.
My Snowball bush is
they're
probably
10 to 12 feet.
Yeah.
Unpruned.
10 feet high.
You know, a lot of them do. There's one called Leatherleaf Viburnum that's semi-evergreen that you see at apartment complexes quite a bit because it's so low maintenance. It will get 12 feet tall easily, but there's others like Watanabe, 3 or 4 feet. There's American cranberry bush viburnum or American snowball bush. There's varieties of it and European cranberry viburnum that stay 3 to 4 feet tall. So they're just dwarf. So there's all sorts of sizes out there. The cranberry bush viburnums, both American and European, are somewhat shade tolerant. And so you can grow them on the east side of your home if you need a shrub that will tolerate that. And they just have kind of a, when I say a relaxed feel, it's not that they look shabby at all. They mm-hmm. don't, but they just lend to a cottage garden feel, the cranberry bush viburnums. And so there's just so much diversity in
are
the
these
group.
Water-wise?
Moderately. They, once established with a couple of inches of mulch over the top, want to be watered about to a depth of a foot every couple of weeks.
You mentioned low care, so they don't need a lot of fertilization or
no,
anything.
No, pretty disease resistant. Every once in a while, you will see some iron chlorosis in them if they are planted in really alkaline soil or if they're overwatered. But a few of them, like the snowball bush, are susceptible to aphids. In fact, that's one of the downfalls of actual snowball, is the aphid problem with it. And so there's ways around that. You can do some dormant oil treatments, a systemic or something, but for the most part, they are not really susceptible to a lot of diseases
okay.
or pests.
I know we're going to get texts asking again what the fragrant ones were, so I'm going to have you repeat those.
Birkwood and Pink Dawn are the two most common, and there's some varieties of Birkwood out there, but then also Korean Spice, and one called Cayuga Fragrant Viburnum.
Okay. Because there's nothing like walking out onto the patio or onto your porch and just enjoying that wonderful fragrance in the spring.
Yeah. So if you've ever walked onto a patio in the South or in California and smelled gardenia or some of these really fragrant bushes, when these are in bloom, the fragrance is different, but still it has that quality to it that just a really pleasing scent.
Yeah, and these are some of the earliest bloomers. What is
they
their
are.
Bloom time?
Bloom time's right with Forsythia.
Okay. We're going to take a break. You can find out
I should
one more thing.
Clarify okay. some of them are right with Forsythia, so the
okay.
Birkwood and Pink Dawn, but others like Snowball Bush are going to be late April into mid-May. And so it varies, but they're usually spring. There's a few out there like Watanabe that will bloom sporadically through the summer.
All right. Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. You can find out more about the viburnum on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page. You can also text us your questions at 57500.
The Greenhouse Show on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria and Ton with you, taking your calls at 801-575-8255. You can also text at 57500. First, texter Ton says they have some white mildew on their orchid leaves. What do they do?
Wash it off and see if that helps. You just get a mild soapy solution. Oftentimes, if I've not heard of orchids getting powdery mildew.
Me neither.
But if they do, sometimes a soapy solution will knock them out. It could also be hard water just from our alkaline water coming out of our taps. It could be dust. There are a lot of different things, but if there's a white powdery substance, I would just get a small container of just lukewarm Dawn, you know, just using Dawn dish soap or something similar, and see if you can wash it off.
Just wash it off.
Yes.
Okay. Next person says they have finished pruning their trees and grapes. What vegetable seeds should they be starting today?
Boy, let's see. It's late February, so it's getting about time. So any of the coal crops can be started. If you're going to transplant them outside, you can also start lettuce. You know, one that people think I'm silly sometimes, but I like mustard greens. And it's not that I enjoy eating them per se, but just to see people's reactions when you have a salad and they bite into one of those mustard green leaves.
Oh.
You get that kind of peppery bite mm-hmm. from them and it quickly goes away. But those can be started right now. But any of the coal crops and lettuce can be started.
It's like your human experience to see how people react to your mustard
greens. I used to work at Sam's Club and I was the hot dog stand boy.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of my first college jobs, and I was growing three or four kinds of hot peppers in my garden. And so I grew some Thai dragon chilies.
Oh.
And, you know, at the hot dog stands, you have a container of pickled jalapenos. And so I decided I got the brine from the jalapenos, and I put my Thai dragons in there.
Uh-huh.
And I had a sign that said, warning, extremely hot. And, you know, use caution. And, oh, I had a good 4 or 5 hours of entertainment of people putting
until
that on there.
Until you were scolded.
Well, my manager found out. And he had been reviewing the footage from the security cameras. And he came out and he couldn't even keep from laughing. But he says, we're liable for that. You need to dump them.
Oh, my goodness.
But, man, you'd hear people, oh, my goodness, what is this? And people... I didn't, nobody asked for refunds.
Well, because you warned them.
Yes, but.
And nobody sued, thank goodness.
Yeah, thank goodness. And that was a huge liability. Fortunately, I was a naive college student and the manager found some humor in it, but that was something that I was not allowed to do again.
No, I'm sure not. Roger is on the line in Linton. Good morning, Roger. What is your question?
Thank you for taking my call. I have a 1 acre pasture behind my house that I bought a bag, like 40 pound bag of dry land pasture seed from IFA, and wondering what time this spring do I need to put that down so it'll germinate and take off?
Well, as soon as you can. It actually should have gone down last fall.
Okay.
In late October to mid-November, so that rain and snow would have worked it into the soil a bit. You're going to want that seed covered with at least a quarter of an inch of soil, and that is kind of difficult to do with a landscape rake because what will happen is as you drag that rake, it exposes some seed and buries some seed too deeply, and you get patches of grass that germinate. And so I don't suppose you do, but do you know if you have access to a seed drill?
I don't.
Okay. I've heard that some rental companies will have a walk-behind seed drill. I heard rumors Home Depot, I think in West Jordan, may have had one. You may call around because they're hard to find, but there are walk-behind seed drills that will just put the seed into the soil for you at the right depth. But if you do need to seed that, the seed can go down, but it can't dry out. And so if you did put it down, I would actually get it down as soon as you can.
Okay, this is a great week to do it. It's going to be sunny and a little warmer, so.
All right, Roger, thanks so much for your call this morning.
Next, thank you.
You bet. Ton, next listener says, is it okay to start pruning their 3-year-old trees and bushes? They said that they heard last week that it's not a good time to prune during wet weather.
Oh, people have got the itch, and I understand
it.
It's
going to be a beautiful day today.
Yeah, and I was looking on Utah Gardening Experts in the posts awaiting approval a couple times, and about 80% of them were, can I prune my fruit trees? Can I prune my roses? And people have got the itch, and so... apples and pears need to be pruned, and if you must, it looks like the weather's going to hold that you could prune your shrubs that are not spring bloomers. I would wait for mid-March, but if you have to, for whatever reason, you can do it. And then I would wait another couple of weeks on the stone fruits.
So what about apple? Somebody's asking about apple.
Get them done. It actually should have been started last week, and so it's a perfect time, so get those done.
They don't need to take any precautions.
No, they don't.
All right. Next person says, when can I start squash from seed, and where is a good place to get sweet meat seeds? What are sweet meat seeds?
Sweet meat's kind of squash. It's a heirloom variety that is just a sweet squash.
Mm-hmm.
So where do you get squash seeds? Is that what they're asking?
The sweet meat ones. Sweet they're meats? Wondering if there's a special
I would
place
just get
those.
Online and search variety because there are several companies that carry them, but they're most likely going to need to be ordered online. I don't know of one specifically off the top of my head, but I actually did an internet search on these 5 or 6 weeks ago, and there were 3 or 4 that you could order them from.
Right. Next, this is a Facebook question that we got. The person wants to know if the Gurney's Asparabest is suitable for growing in the Salt Lake Valley. I'm assuming that's asparagus, right?
Any asparagus is going to do fine here.
Okay, so they asked if not, what is a good option?
There are many that do well. I believe the old-fashioned variety is it Martha Washington, I believe, is the old-fashioned variety. And I'd actually
never grown asparagus.
Avoid that one. Because there are many varieties that are much more productive. So asparagus, you plant in early spring, and there you have to dig a trench and plant the root starts, and then they grow up, and you bury them in a couple of times. And you don't actually start harvesting a lot of asparagus until the third year.
Mm-hmm.
So, but they'll last and be really productive for 25 to 50 years, and a lot of the modern varieties don't go to seed. And what that means for you is more asparagus. And so you want to find more modern varieties. USU has a really useful asparagus fact sheet that they can look up. Dan Drost, the gentleman that wrote it, is actually a worldwide expert on asparagus.
Okay.
And he's written pretty much the Bible on it. He's a worldwide expert in onions and asparagus.
So Google USU and asparagus.
Yes, and look at his fact sheet, and it'll give you everything you need to know. But use the modern varieties because they're more productive than the old-fashioned ones.
Okay, we're going to take a break. Our next listener is saying, though, that they have their crocuses opening and the bees are enjoying them.
Nice.
So wonderful. Right. Thanks for your text. Take a break. The number to call is 801-575-8255. Text us 57500.
The Greenhouse Show on KSL News Radio.
Good morning, Maria Chalaos, Ton Bettis with you, taking your calls at 801-575-8255. Phone lines are open, and you can also text us your questions at 57500. Ton, our next listener is wondering if it's time to apply chelated iron to raspberries.
You can. The raspberries are still very dormant, and so if you had to, you could, but I would wait until mid to late March.
Okay.
Because even though the tops aren't growing by mid-March, the roots are.
Okay.
And they're uptaking a lot of nutrients.
Next listener says they have a 3-year-old sunburst honey locust that has the strangest shape, very tall and droopy center stem, and then very long, straggly branches. Any hints on how and when to prune it so it's a pretty shaped tree?
Some of the branches probably need to be headed back, and so we're going to use a pruning technique called heading cuts.
Oh.
And so they can look up pruning shade trees. USU has some useful fact sheets. But if the trunk is narrow and eventually won't support the canopy because of just the extent of the branches, I probably would do some heading cuts to see if I could get the tree back into proportion. And for branches that are still a little wispy, they can use bamboo stakes and just stake a branch using bamboo and use zip ties, not super tight, or the wire ties that you like on bread sacks.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually buy a roll of that at local garden centers and wire tie that so it straightens the branch. And then if they need to, they can also put stakes in the ground, almost like you would use for pouring cement, and pull branches in certain directions tied to the stakes. And so you can train the tree, but if it's young, the honey locusts do have sometimes a tendency to do that. And I would just go ahead and look up USU and tree pruning, and it'll bring up a few fact sheets.
Okay. Next listener has an English walnut tree that's about 40 years old. It's been a great producer, but some of the branches are dying, and they're wondering if those branches were pruned out, could they save the tree?
It depends. 3 years ago, we had one of these winters that we had a late September freeze down to, I think, 18 degrees, mm-hmm. and all the trees were still green. The walnuts really took it on the nose, and probably 50% of the walnuts in northern Utah from, you know, almost Cedar City north were really damaged to where the canopy of the tree was killed back to about the top 2/3 of the canopy was killed. And you would get sporadic growth, and then you had fairly healthy growth in the lower canopy. If that happened, the tree may eventually recover, but if it's a branch here and a branch there, there could be a disease in it called thousand cankers, and the trees don't recover from that. And so what I would do is look up USU and thousand cankers disease, look for borer holes, and you might need to cut off into some of the bark to see if it's black and there's galleries underneath and things. But if it is thousand cankers, unfortunately, I don't think the tree will not recover.
They're wondering if it does die, can they plant another tree in the same place?
Yeah, they can. I would not plant another walnut there. They could plant another one in the yard. If they can find one, Japanese walnut is really nice because they only get about 30 feet tall, so half the size of a regular walnut tree. But another species, they absolutely could.
Stephen Cottonwood Heights would like us to repeat some of the information we gave on the seed exchange. Do you remember the information on the seed exchange?
Oh, we'd have to dig it up off Facebook.
I'm going to look it up. So, Steve, okay. Hang on. We'll look that one up. Next person wants to know, what is a good quick-growing ground cover for an arid area that needs little water and can take dog and chicken traffic?
Oh, boy. Unfortunately, there's nothing that exists. You know, it just... you're looking at bark mulch, honestly, because no plants will tolerate constant dog traffic without water, especially. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, there are ground covers that would be fabulous, but there's just, with all those requirements, you're looking at either gravel or bark mulch.
Next listener wants to know if it's a good idea to clean your pruners before each use to prevent infection, and they want to know if alcohol would work to clean them.
Rubbing alcohol is fine. What I like to do is just get some rubbing alcohol, and I go to the dollar store, local grocery store, and get one of the spray bottles you would use for ironing, like you just spray the mist water on it. Mm-hmm. I'll put rubbing alcohol in there, and if I'm just doing general pruning, what I will do is use rubbing alcohol to sterilize the pruners after I'm done. But you need to be careful because even rubbing alcohol over time can be somewhat corrosive. And so Lysol is something they can use. But Mike actually teaches a lot of yard tool maintenance classes, Mike Karen. Mm-hmm. And one thing he likes to do is to get, what's the name of it? It's a citrus oil cleaner.
Oh.
And he'll wash, because it seems to break through you get the plant sap and things on there. And so rubbing alcohol will break through it too. But whenever you're done, they always get cleaned up. And you can use soapy water, but you need to thoroughly dry them so they don't rust. And another thing you can do is you actually don't want to use WD-40 to lubricate them, because it's actually not designed for that. It only lasts for a couple of weeks before it gets gummy, but a good penetrating oil, you know, a machine oil or another just lube that is longer lasting, you can do a light coat of oil to help them prevent them from rusting to keep them lubricated.
All right, Steve had asked us about the seed exchange, and our wonderful producer, Michelle, has gotten us the information. It's the Ogden Seed Exchange. The hours are 10 to 1 today, and it's happening at the Ogden Preparatory Academy. We're going to take a break, come back with more of your questions and calls. The number to call, 801-575-8255. You can text us, 57500. Good morning. Thanks for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse, spending your Saturday morning with Ton and me. Phone lines are open at 801-575-8255. You can also text us at 57500. Ton, next person wants to know, why doesn't their wisteria bloom?
It just doesn't, and you'll get about 10% of them that don't, and you never know why.
What? So they need to start over with a different plant?
They may.
How long do you wait?
Some of them are in the ground. They'll bloom at the garden center. You bring them home, and they don't get a flower on them for 10 years, and you never know. You know, pruning them, you know, if you cut them down every year, that will prevent them from blooming. If you have them in too much shade, that could prevent them from blooming. But there's just a certain percentage that for some reason just don't bloom. And I want to go back to the Bible parable where there's the fig tree without fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus basically strikes it dead because it's unuseful for not producing fruit. And it's not that I want to do that to all the wisteria, but you unfruitful plant, how right. dare you not flower? And we planted you, and there are apple trees sometimes do that. There's just a few plants that every once in a while, it may be 15 years before they ever produce a blossom. And so you can, if it's just growing and you're leaving it alone, then, you know, if you know it didn't get hard frost, you know, if you're up in the Cache Valley, wisteria is a little marginal. If it gets exposed to temperatures below about minus 10, but if you're leaving it alone and it's, we've had a moderate winter this year and it doesn't bloom, then it may be a number of years before it ever does.
Okay. Next listener says they've grown their tomatoes and peppers from seed indoors and they want to try growing Utah tall celery. How soon should they start their celery seed indoors?
So they should have been started 2 weeks ago.
So they better start it now.
Yes. Now, Utah actually was once upon a time a fairly major celery producer.
Hmm.
The colder mountain valleys like Cache Valley stayed cool enough in the summer for celery to thrive. And it's not an easy crop because it likes cooler temperatures, but it takes several months in the growing season to get it mature. And so people will grow it, but if you read some old-fashioned gardening magazines and catalogs and guides, it will say, do not grow celery if you're an inexperienced gardener because of how difficult it can be. And so if you want to try a row, that's great. And then the other reason they say not to do it, because once it's harvested, unless you can somehow preserve it in some stews or similarly, that you've got a couple of weeks before it really starts to go bad. And so it has to be used soon. And there might be some ways to store it longer for a few months. But it's one of those that we grew a lot of celery through the 40s, 50s, 60s before like Dole and other Green Giant and things started consolidating where they grow into fewer areas but bigger acreages. We used to grow quite a bit of it.
Interesting. Next listener says one of their trees had borers last year. Is it going to be able to be saved this year? And what should they use and when?
Just knowing that it had borers actually doesn't get us very far because okay. we need to know the tree and the species of borer, at least what the borers are doing. If it's a peach tree, treatments are one way. If it's an ash tree, if it's a maple. So unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to help much with just that information.
Okay, well, what if it is just a peach tree?
A greater peach tree borer, if the tree was relatively healthy still, it can be salvaged. Once it's damaged, the injury, the tree puts off a certain pheromone that attracts more peach tree borers to it. And so they're going to have to double up their efforts if that's what it is. But you have to spray a preventative pyrethroid, and there are several of them out there registered, every 3 to 4 weeks on the trunk and especially around the base starting in June through September.
Okay, so they really need to get on it in June if it is a peach tree. All right. We do have Clint from the Utah Giant Pumpkin Growers who wants to come on the air and talk with us one day. And Clint, we'll have our producer get your number. And yeah, we'd love to talk about giant pumpkins. So many different varieties of pumpkins that you can actually plant here and have do well if you plant them early enough in the season.
Yeah, I think that it might have been Clint that several years ago, somebody made a small documentary on competition and rivalries between giant pumpkin growers. Because
there is such a thing?
There is.
And I mean, I know there are contests, but...
Yeah, the variety that most people are growing is called Dill's Atlantic Giant. But the seeds you buy from the garden center might get, you know, 200 or 300 pounds. But depending on how you back cross them, and there's something called the ploidy level, and there's a few different ways you can tweak these to get them even bigger. And if you're a giant pumpkin grower, you're not sharing seeds if you had a champion pumpkin.
Of course not.
Because of the work that goes into breeding that. And so, you know, just because you bought the seeds from the store, you're still probably not in the ball game for some of the more competitive growers.
Well, we'd love to hear from you, Clint. So we'll get back with you on that. How soon do you have to start pumpkin seeds to really be successful? I mean, I started mine really late and the vine was great and I got a few pumpkins, but they weren't quite ripe when I wanted them to be. So when's the best, how early can you start them?
Well, if you're growing jack-o'-lanterns, which is going to be totally different than giant pumpkins, but mm-hmm. jack-o'-lanterns, a lot of our commercial growers don't even start them until the 1st of June.
Okay.
Just because if you start them in mid-May, they do fine, but oftentimes those pumpkins will turn orange in early September. And if you pick them and put them in an area, you know, on some wood or just where they are dry and in the shade, they will cure and harden off and last, but they want to time them ripening in mid-September. And so around late May to early June is when I would put them in.
Okay. We need to take a break for the top of the hour news. Number for you to call, 801-575-8255. You can text us at 57500. This morning, the plant of the week was the viburnum. You can check out more information on that on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page. And we'll be back with more of your calls and questions here on KSL News Radio.
The Greenhouse Show on KSL News Radio.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Chaleos, Anton Bettis with you this morning. We are taking your calls at 801-575-8255. You can also text us at 57500. This morning, we wanted to talk about the feature of the 9 o'clock hour is dwarf fruit trees. And the reason that we wanted to talk about this week is because last week we spent some time talking about how many people are needing to grow in smaller spaces, yards are shrinking, and so you want to take on the dwarf fruit trees.
I do, and there's not a lot of them out there, but there's enough, especially in apples and in peaches, that even pears sometimes, that you can grow fruit trees in a small yard. And you know, is the harvest going to be something that you're producing fruit to last the entire year? It's not. But, you know, I grew up, my dad had a dwarf apple tree, and it was a golden delicious, and it got 6 or 8, about 6 feet high and wide, mm-hmm. and we still could pick at least a half bushel of apples off it. And that's a lot of apples still that mm-hmm. you could make some sauce. That's what my mom did, is made sauce out of them. But there, you still can get some pretty good production off of these dwarf trees.
So when we first put in our yard, we put in a dwarf apricot and a dwarf peach, but they didn't last very long. Are there new varieties that let them live longer, or is that just what you get
in
with a dwarf tree?
Stone fruits, the dwarf trees seem to last 10 to 15
yeah,
years.
That's about right.
And that's just their average lifespan. They just don't last quite as long as the larger trees. And I've read that several times, and I'm not quite sure why they don't last as long. But, and so if you have that, it might be something you plant one, wait 3 or 4 years, plant another, wait 3 or 4 years, plant another, so that as one phases out, you have this 3 or 4 year rotation that you have one started. And so you can keep them in that way. And then in the apples, you actually have several options because you can get apples grafted onto a dwarfing rootstock such as Bud 9. And I know that people are like, what? And so if you look up apple rootstocks, you can order these sometimes online. Now, it's going to be harder to find them. Sometimes garden centers may have them. But if you graft apples onto a dwarfing rootstock, you can grow almost any apple variety. And it will max out 10 to 12 feet, 9 feet, just right in that area, depending on how it's pruned. Apples are going to need to be staked and supported with a T-post or something similar. But there's also columnar apples out there. The fruit quality isn't quite what, you know, like Gala, Fuji would be, but they're still pretty good. And they only get about 4 feet wide, and they just grow up in a column. So there are lots of options. You know, you mentioned the apricots. There are cherries that are becoming a little more common that are grafted on dwarfing rootstock that max out about 10 feet. So you can get Bean or Lambert or Benton, you know, some of the popular varieties. And then another thing we don't consider, but even in plums, there are some dwarf plums, but the Native American plums, there's several named varieties that the fruit gets a little bit bigger than their wild cousins that max out about 10 to 12 feet.
Are you limited in varieties for peach and apricot?
You are, because there's 4 or 5 common dwarf peaches. A lot of them have been bred by Zager Genetics out of California. So it is Pick Z. But Zager's has 3 or 4 dwarf peaches. There's others like Bonanza and Bonfire. And there's other dwarf fruit, but you are limited on the varieties in peaches. But again, it's one of those things that the fruit is going to be good and you can process it and things, but it's not going to be a lemon Alberta peach that you're canning or for eating and things. And so the fruit quality is still there, but sometimes the semi-dwarf or the standard fruit trees, because we've put a lot more into them, there's just a lot more named varieties.
Well, the one thing I loved about it is I don't want to put up too many peaches. So it was nice. We could pick enough peaches to eat in our home, and then I could make a dessert with them, a few cobblers, and, you know, freeze a few. But it wasn't. Sometimes when you have a big peach tree, I mean, you have to take care of these things, and then you have fruit to disperse to people if you're not going to be bottling them or
you
whatever.
You do. And I mean, and so you, that's exactly what they do. You have enough for fresh eating, for some desserts. And then if you want 4 or 5 pounds to freeze or 6 or 8 jars, there's enough for that. And then you're done.
Right.
And you're not.
That's great for a lot of us.
It is. And you don't need marriage counseling. And
who's going to go out there and pick them, and who's going to pick up the
mess? Yeah, but it's not just the picking them's the easy part.
You have to take care of the tree.
Yeah, taking care of the tree and then processing them. There's so much that goes into it. And so it's just a fun thing. So I would imagine that you probably had a variety called Bonanza.
It was planted 30 years ago.
Yeah, and so that was the common green one then, was Bonanza. There's another called Bonfire that has red leaves. And then the peaches are a reddish tinted peach, but the tree is just gorgeous because you get these brilliant fuchsia pink blossoms on red foliage, and it stays burgundy red most of the summer.
Okay.
So the Bonfire peach is just a gorgeous one. And so it has the advantage that you can still use the peaches for cobblers and fresh eating and things.
And then you have a beautiful tree all season long.
And it's a showpiece. And again, it's a 10 to 15 year tree. That's just what you expect out of it. But they are just absolutely gorgeous.
And then with these dwarf trees, you still have to spray
and do
all of this stuff, right?
You do. And so
maybe that's why ours didn't live very long.
You can maintain them organically and do a great job. But if you have fruit trees and you're like, well, I'm pesticide free, just buy your fruit from a local grower. There are more and more growing organic. And just leave it out of your yard, because those trees become a hot spot for diseases and pests that then spread to other trees of people that are taking care of them. And so when you're growing fruit trees, you can grow them for ornament, but you also need to consider that they're a commodity and they require not a lot of maintenance, but regular maintenance, whether you're pruning or spraying or picking the fruit. And so be willing to do that and have a conversation with yourself and your significant other on, are we going to do this long term, or, you know, because you'll pay $60 to $100 for a dwarf peach and then another probably $10 to $20 per tree to keep them sprayed for peach tree borer and a few other things. And so you ask yourself, can I just buy the fruit for the cost of the tree and maintaining it and be happy?
Yeah, it's a commitment.
It is.
All right. Anything else you want to add?
Look, get creative. I think that over the next 20 to 30 years, as our population grows, that's what we're going to be doing to maintain our tradition of gardening.
All right. You can find out more about the dwarf fruit trees we've been talking about on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page. We have posted an article there. Call us now. The phone lines are open at 801-575-8255. You can also text us at 57500. Good morning, and thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse, spending your Saturday morning with us. Phone lines are open right now at 801-575-8255. You want to get your calls in now, because this is a shortened edition of the KSL Greenhouse. We're going to only go till 10 o'clock this morning due to our BYU basketball coverage.
I'm not sure if this is in order, but there's an interesting text that says, can you have beehives and still use pesticides on your fruit trees? And I think it's really appropriate and an intelligent question.
Okay.
The answer is absolutely, for several reasons. One is, you're never spraying a fruit tree with an insecticide when it's in bloom. And so that's the primary time that honeybees and other pollinators are going to be harmed by a spray. But even then, if you maintained your fruit trees organically, and I'm not talking, again, pesticide free, but if you use organic options such as spinosad and maybe pyrethrins, horticultural soaps and oils, those sorts of insecticides are also usually minimally harmful. And because you're not spraying, again, any of these things when the trees are in bloom, you're naturally protecting those anyway. But so a lot of the organic chemistries don't have a very long residual, and so even danger of sublethal doses are going to be minimized. So you can keep your fruit trees fairly clean of pests organically on a good, when I say judicious, I guess judicious is the word I want, not religious, but judicious, yes, spray schedule. Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be pollinator safe. You can have your beehives and be totally fine.
Okay, we were talking about celery earlier. This next listener wanted to know, why does their celery grow all over the place?
Their celery, if Jimmy Carter was regular celery, theirs was normal celery, their celery would be Billy Carter.
What? Now, many people would not understand.
You probably
that
have to be of a certain age,
right,
to know
I'm
who Billy
say,
Carter
younger
is.
People are not going to understand.
Billy
this.
Carter was pretty much Jimmy Carter's wild and woolly brother that was always getting into trouble with different
so
things.
So you're saying their celery is getting into trouble?
Well, the only thing I can really figure, there's not a thing out there with a disease that causes celery to grow in a twisted habit. I'm wondering maybe if it was exposed to an herbicide like 2,4-D that could cause that. But you can stake the celery. And I think the outer stalks will naturally kind of bend over. And so what you're supposed to do, as the celery matures, the outer stalks can actually be harvested ahead of the entire plant. And so as summer progresses and the outer stalks are getting, you know, that 2 or 3 inches wide, you can peel those off and leave the inner stalks there that are going to be straighter. And then at the end of the season, harvest those inner stalks when they're between 2 and 3 inches wide at the base. And they look like something you would get from the grocery store. But we don't realize this, but the celery we purchase from the grocery store that's still in kind of that bundle, they've peeled the outer stalks off before it's shipped to market. And if those outer stalks are usable, they're often going into processed, when I say processed foods, like frozen dinners, stews, the canned stews and things like that.
I've been on this diet. I just mentioned that a few minutes ago, and I didn't realize how much I really enjoy cooked celery. Because whenever I think of celery, I think of just, you know, raw celery.
Slathering the peanut butter on it or whatever you do.
Why is it sweet when you cook it? It's so delicious.
It is good. My wife generally doesn't like celery, but if it's in a stew or a soup, she's like, oh, we need the celery.
Yeah, it's delicious. Next listener says, I planted new peach and apple trees last spring. Their dog chewed off all the lower branches. Is there any way that I can prune these new trees to stimulate new lower branches?
That may actually shoot them out on their, they could just regrow them from secondary buds. So all is not lost. As long as the dog didn't chew the bark off, and they're lucky it didn't.
Right.
You know, the orchard area, especially with young trees, is something that if you have dogs, has to be fenced off so that the dogs can't get to them. Or you're constantly watching them because, as you know, from personal experience, puppies chew on anything.
They pull branches off Japanese maples.
It's just part of almost like a baby wanting to taste everything, put everything in its mouth. Puppies do the same thing. And so if you have especially larger, you know, German Shepherd, Lab, you know, some of the larger dog breeds that are puppies, they will tear up a yard. And so you may need to put in some temporary posts with some fencing to keep the dogs away until the trees are mature enough and their dogs are old enough to know not to do that.
Our next listener would like you to give them some options, best options for a privacy hedge here in Salt Lake.
There are many out there. And, you know, for a privacy hedge, it's not super common, but Progressive Plants carries a privet called Straight Talk Privet that's a columnar privet. There's Tall Hedge Buckthorn, if they can get a little wider. There are other privets out there. Golden Privet is a sterile privet that it does flower, but it's usually fruitless. There are a number of lilacs, Rose of Sharon. So I wish we knew the size, eventual size, what they wanted in size, so I could be a little more specific.
The next person wants to create a low boxwood hedge with English dwarf boxwood. They were told to plant them 2 feet apart. Now, they have not made a degree. Let me see here.
Have they not filled in?
Yeah, they've not filled in. They would like to fill in between them, but they're afraid of cutting into the roots. There you go.
Well, depending on what dwarf boxwood, they still, over time, will get 3 to 4 feet, and so they will fill in, but at the base of the shrubs, you might have a little bit of an arc shape because the shrub's rounded nature, so you have an arch in the middle to where there's no foliage. They eventually would fill in, but the boxwoods are a little slow, but I don't think if they could find the same variety so that the leaves match, digging a 6-inch hole with a 1-gallon pot to put in between them would not harm anything.
Yeah, they were wondering if there were young, small starts of boxwood.
The smallest you can generally find are the number one nursery pots. And smaller than that, you may, but when they get too small, I hate to plant them outdoors just because that small size sometimes makes it so that their survival rates aren't as high.
Okay, we need to take a break for the bottom of the hour news. Number to call, 801-575-8255. Text us, 57500.
The Greenhouse Show on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Chaleos, Ton Bettis with you, taking your calls at 801-575-8255. You can also text us at 57500. Let's go to our phone lines. Russ has been waiting patiently in Lehigh. Good morning, Russ. What was your question this morning?
Yes, I've got evergreens and pine trees, and I'm wondering about, I compost with stair manure over the years, and some are older and some are younger, but can you use, and I know iron makes your grass green. Do you put iron around your evergreen trees, or shrubs and bushes?
It depends on the species, because our evergreens, if they're Austrian pine, Scots pine, they are usually efficient at getting iron out of our soil. If they're going yellow, it's usually the weather or overwatering that's causing it. And honestly, your turf, even, unless your soil is really alkaline, the pH of around 8 is the border for it. But your turf is even very efficient at getting iron out of the soil up to a pH of about 8. And so you may not need it. If you do want to apply it, the ironite products, they're effective, but they can be bound up fairly quickly. And so chelated irons like EDDHA iron are going to be the ones that are more effective. But when you're paying $25 a pound, you know, the lobster prices, then it becomes something for me, at least, that I'm only going to apply them if my plants need it.
How about organic nitrogen or something like that?
It's fine. Again, if they are growing well, Austrian pines in a healthy situation with sufficient water will grow at the tips 18 inches a year. If they're doing that, there's no reason to fertilize. But you could put down, depending on the size of the tree, anywhere from a quarter to a half a cup of fertilizer under the base of the tree, just spread out under the branches, and it wouldn't hurt anything.
Yeah, I've done that over the years. I've got young ones and old ones. And
yeah, the older ones, spruce. I wouldn't worry nearly as much about fertilizing if they're already up to size.
How about evergreen bushes? I've got those that spread out, you know.
For trees and shrubs, I only recommend fertilizing them on an as-need basis. And if they're growing well, don't fertilize them.
Compost around them? Compost
is fine. An inch or two every year is fine. It mimics our natural environment. But the fertilizers, there's just no need about 85% of the time once a plant is established. If it's growing, you know, well, don't fertilize it.
Well, mine are growing well. And I know Lehigh, where I'm at, has alkaline.
Well, everywhere it does.
So everywhere. Yeah, you can't grow blueberries or something.
No, you can't. So I think that I would consider just using your compost and just going from there. So we really appreciate the call. So.
All right. Thanks, Russ, for your call this morning. Next listener, Ton, says, is it too early to prune the boxwood photinia bush or the auto cherry lichen bush?
Give it another couple of weeks until we get into mid-March. I just wouldn't jump the gun.
The pruner's away.
And if you want to enjoy the flowers on your auto lichens laurels, then I would actually prune them when they're done blooming. They're not like super spectacular, but they are pretty. The auto lichens laurels are actually an evergreen cherry, and they look like an upright Canada Red choke cherry blossom, a panicle of them.
Oh.
And so they can be pretty. And so you could prune them in mid-March, but if you want the flowers, wait until they're done. Photinia, you actually shear in mid-March because you want new growth, because it gets its other name, red tip, from the new growth that comes out of really solid, bright red and then eventually fades to green.
Oh, okay. Sue is on the line in Elmo. Good morning, Sue. What was your question?
Morning. I wondered if I could get some advice on how to keep deer out of my trees and gardens. We live very rural, so we have quite a few deer.
I drive through Elmo occasionally. I cover both Utah and Juab counties, and we have family down south of you in Circleville. So depending on the direction we go, Elmo is one of the ways we go. But at any rate, the only sure way to do it, besides moving, is to put up 8-foot fences. And so in your critical area, say you have a vegetable garden or a small orchard, you can get 10-foot T-posts and put them into the ground and stretch pasture fencing, not just wire, but actual, you know, expanded metal or something similar. And if it's 8 feet tall, and you'll need to make some sort of gate to get in, but if it's 8 feet tall, the deer will not go in it.
Okay.
Otherwise, 8 feet is the critical height, and they will not hop that unless they're threatened by a predator. And so if there happen to be a coyote or a bobcat or a cougar in the vicinity, than they might, mm-hmm. but they won't jump 8 feet. The other thing you could try, but you would have to be almost religious about it, but there are several repellents you can purchase for deer and spray on the plants. And there's like coyote urine, cougar urine, hot sauce, and clarified egg extract sprays. A few of them have spreader stickers in them that will last a couple of weeks if you buy them commercially. But you're going to be out there spraying every time you irrigate, or at least once a week, because there's other food sources during the summer, and you make the plants taste nasty enough that the deer just feed on something else.
I think we'd try the 8-foot fence.
Now, honestly, the upfront cost is greater, but just the ability to keep the deer out is so worth doing that. The orchards that are in Santa Quinn, that's what they've done in many areas. And yes, the upfront cost is high sometimes, but they don't have deer problems anymore.
Okay.
All right, Sue.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your call this morning. Next listener, Tom, has two little Kim lilac bushes. They're 2 years old on the west side of a vinyl fence that just won't grow. They want to know, are they slow growers? And they want to know if maybe it's too hot. Where is a better place to transplant them and when?
Vinyl fences just don't heat up that hot unless they're black for some reason.
Okay, so it's not the vinyl that's the problem.
It could be that you're just slow. Every once in a while, especially Miss Kim or Dwarf Korean Lilac, just they don't take off very well. And it's like we were talking about the wisteria earlier, maybe 1 in 10 just never really thrives.
But two of them?
But if there's two of them, what I would do is get 1/4 cup of lawn fertilizer, as long as it's not weed and feed, and put it around the base of the shrubs, spread out in a 2 by 2 foot area over the roots, and do that in mid to late March and see if that stimulates growth. If it doesn't, then there may be a root disease in them that's not killing them, but not allowing them to thrive.
Okay, so moving them wouldn't be the solution.
And moving them, I would also dig a hole in between them and see if you have standing water that comes in, or when you irrigate, if you have standing water, overwatering would do this too.
All right, we're going to take a break. Come back with the final segment of the show. The number to call, 801-575-8255. You can text us at 57500. Thanks for being with us on this Saturday morning. Maria and Ton taking your calls, 801-575-8255. Probably shouldn't prompt the phones too much. Only about 5 minutes left in the show. You can text us at 57500. Let's get to as many of these texts as we can. Next person would like to know, is it okay to spread out mill organic on the lawn?
It's probably mill organite.
What is that?
And Autocorrect got them, but it's a fertilizer.
Okay.
It's processed from, the fancy term is biosolids, but it's sewage waste. And that sounds so gross and whatever, but it's processed so that it's safe. And the reason it's out on the market is that I'm not sure if it's certified organic, but it has a dark color to it, and they can pelletize it. And the primary use has been on golf courses on their putting greens, because when they're snow covered, they're really susceptible to a disease called snow mold. And snow mold can devastate the bent grass, kill it. And, you know, you get those brown patches, but bent grass is highly susceptible. And so golf course superintendents will go out in the middle of the winter on their putting greens and apply mill organite after snowstorms, because the dark color melts the snow off much more quickly. And it's the analysis, I think it's like between 7% and 9% nitrogen. And it's a slow release because it is organic, because it has to be broken down by microorganisms. And so the nitrogen they're adding isn't harming anything, because it's just such a slow release and the analysis is low enough. And so homeowners will sometimes use it, but I've actually been recommending it or activated carbon in those areas of your own yard where you have shade and the grass gets snow mold, to just spread it right over those areas. And so even in shaded areas, when that absorbs the sun's heat, it will melt the snow off faster in those areas too.
Okay. Next listener says they have Russian olive suckers coming up in their pasture. Is it too early to cut and paint them with Roundup concentrate?
It's not. They'll get better effect in the spring when the tree's actively growing. But the time to actually do that is in September and early October when they're drawing nutrients down from the leaves to the roots. With glyphosate, whether it's kills all, Roundup, whatever, you can get almost 100% kill on Russian olive when that is applied in the fall.
Mm-hmm. Next person has started seeds indoors, was wondering if they needed to start planting them outside due to their size. And they're wondering what they could do to protect them from the cold weather.
We would need to know what they are. If it's cool season stuff, they may be able to protect it with their unseasonably warm weather. But without more information, we can't really answer. But all I would say is don't get
too
excited.
Still pretty cold, right?
It is. Cool season crops go in soon. But yeah, don't get too excited.
Is wood ash useful in the garden?
Not really. We already have a lot of micronutrients in our soil. It has a lot of potassium in it. It's another product that historically has been used to melt snow off of fields. The farmers would put a really light application down. But if you use it, you don't want more than a 16th of an inch because it is super salty. And so if you do need to get rid of it, a super light application, almost like salt and pepper, doesn't harm anything, but no more than that, no more than once a year in the same location.
Next person wants to know, what is the expected lifespan of Japanese barberry or green ash tree?
Barberry, 15 to 25 years. Green ash, if you're trying to plant one, just don't. If you already have one and it's mature, it'll last for years and years. But if it's a fairly new tree, because of the ash lilac borer, those are really hard to get into maturity because the borers tear them up.
Ooh, okay. Can pistachio trees grow anywhere in Utah?
Well, there's some pistachios up in Logan on a really protected area above the island on campus that survived since the 70s, but generally no. There is a Chinese pistache tree that's actually a shade tree. Really beautiful fall color. In warmer areas of the Wasatch Front, it does fine, but it's a different species. And so if you want to play with pistachios, it's like the pomegranates. Bench areas really warm, and they may.
Okay. Thank you so much for listening this morning to the KSL Greenhouse. We are ending early to make way for our BYU basketball coverage later today, and we hope you'll join us next week. And a reminder, you can check us out in podcast form at kslpodcast.com.